This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You might have read the recent revelation that the U.S. sabotaged a Soviet pipeline during the Cold War, which may have contributed to the economic problems that helped lead to the collapse of the Soviet Union. My guest, Thomas Reed, broke that story in his new book, At the Abyss, An Insider's History of the Cold War. Reed has several credentials qualifying him as an insider. As we'll discuss in a few minutes, he helped design nuclear weapons in his work at Lawrence Livermore Laboratory from 1959 to 62. He later helped determine the future of nuclear weapons. He was Secretary of the Air Force from 1966 to 77. He served as President Reagan's Special Assistant for National Security Policy and was a member of the U.S. Strategic Command's Science Advisory Group. Reed was the Northern California chair of Ronald Reagan's first gubernatorial campaign. He spent much of his career in private business. Let's start with the Siberian natural gas pipeline, which the United States blew up. What exactly did we do, and why did we target this pipeline?
Well, first of all, we didn't blow it up. The Soviets blew it up themselves. That we targeted the theft of technology that was going on in direct contravention to the spirit of détente. The Soviets had placed, engaged in massive technological espionage to steal U.S. industrial and defense secrets. One secret they stole was some software, and they then used it inappropriately for reasons we'll get to.
So how did we find out that the Soviets were stealing our technology?
We gained access in 1981 to a KGB officer in the Technical Espionage Directorate, and he showed us what they had been doing for several years, a massive theft of technology, and what they were planning to do. He also gave us the Soviet shopping list, which gave us leads as to what we might take, how we might take corrective action.
So how did we use the shopping list to sabotage the pipeline?
Armed with that intelligence, the conventional wisdom would have been to arrest or deport all the agents and shut the operation down. But it occurred to Mr. Casey and an associate of mine at the NSC, Gus Weiss, instead to help the Russians with their shopping. But that every chip, every turbine blade, every engine, every piece of software would in fact have an added ingredient. And in the case of this particular incident, the Soviets wanted to gain, to get controls, operating systems for the Trans-Siberian pipeline. They bought a computer on the open market, an outdated computer, but it worked. But they could not get the software. So they penetrated a Canadian software firm, and through that channel, they basically stole software from the U.S. The thing is, we knew they were doing that, and so we added to that software what is known as a Trojan horse. And that is a few lines of code that say, run the whole program as planned, but on a certain given day, do something different. In case of the pipeline, we said, run the software as you're supposed to run all the pumps and compressors and valves, but on a certain day, we're going to run a pressure test. On a certain day, we want to run this pipeline at twice its rated pressure. That we expected would rupture the pipeline all over, but in fact it blew up in one spot out in Siberia. The Air Force thought it was a 3-kiloton explosion. The rocket test people thought the Soviets were launching from some unknown location. It was a very visible signal.
So, like, if our experts thought this was a nuclear explosion, how did the people who were in on this operation tell them that it wasn't, that this was actually sabotage?
They didn't tell us it was sabotage, that I worked at the White House, and the White House associate who had been involved in developing this program, which was very tightly controlled by Mr. Casey and Mr. Weiss and a few others, we were looking at the possibilities, they say, of a nuclear explosion or a missile launch, and then Gus Weiss came down the hall and just came into my office and said, don't worry about it. And you ask why once in those circumstances, and they just said, just don't worry about it. And so we said, okay, and turned our attention to other things.
When did you actually learn the truth about this story?
20 years later, when I started working on this book, people began to come forward. You know, the U.S. and the Soviet Union, as superpowers, kept thousands of cards very close to their chest. And it was only as the old-timers began to retire and die off that some of these cards fell to the table, some of them face up, and you could begin to see what was going on. Gus Weiss finally looked me up about a year and a half ago because he heard I was doing this book and said, you know, you need to know about that explosion and what caused it.
Now, he actually died a few months ago, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
You must be glad that he revealed this particular secret before.
Oh, yes, I am.
Before departing.
It's very sad. Well, a lot of the people I've talked to are dying off. I've talked to a very elderly gentleman in Los Angeles who was Howard Hughes' last roommate. I talked to Gus Weiss, who died about a year after talking to me. I've talked to all sorts of Soviet scientists who are falling by the wayside. This has been a race with the Grim Reaper to get some of these stories and then check the facts, because I've learned you got to check every fact, everything that you're told, very carefully.
What's the closest we came to nuclear war that you were able to discover through the research for your book?
I think it happened over and over. The whole point of the book is we came throughout the Cold War over and over. We came perilously close to the use of nuclear weapons or an incident that would have led to such, that we can start back at Cuba. Those who were old enough to remember the Cuban Missile Crisis don't understand how close we came to disaster. The title of this book comes from the message that Khrushchev sent Kennedy, that we are approaching the edge of a nuclear abyss. It turns out the Soviet Union had in Cuba at the time of the crisis 98 nuclear weapons. They were not the warheads for the missiles still en route. They were bombs for aircraft. They were anti-ship missiles, but they were 98 nukes. General Pliev, the general officer in charge of the Soviet forces, got his charter from Khrushchev before he left Moscow. Stay in touch, but if you lose touch and if you come under attack, use your best judgment. If we had gone around starting to bomb airfields in Cuba, undoubtedly there would have been nuclear retaliation. All the way to through Vietnam, not well understood that we, at the very beginning at Dien Bien Phu, some members of the administration, I think John Foster Dulles, as a matter of fact, wanted to give a couple of nukes to the French to help defend Dien Bien Phu. I have no idea how we would do that with nuclear weapons. To various confrontations at sea, up all the way to the end, that really perhaps the most impressive approach to nuclear weapons that is most satisfying is the degree to which the Red Army was responsible and careful in the matter of nukes. We all remember the attempted coup in Moscow in 1991. Gorbachev is down in Crimea. Yeltsin's outside on a tank. Vinayev is inside having a press conference. And in Washington, we're all sweating bullets as to who has the box known as the Cheget, which is the nuclear briefcase that enables the president of Russia or the Soviet Union to fire nuclear weapons. It turns out we didn't need to worry about that. The Soviet general staff decided that this was just too serious and too precarious. They simply, the general staff of the Soviet Union, unplugged the nuclear briefcase that belonged to the political leadership of the Soviet Union.
How did you find out about that?
I found about it basically from two Russians. One was the chief of staff of the Strategic Rocket Forces, and another was a Russian colonel who had been deeply involved in the development of command and control equipment. They both repeated the same story.
What was it like for you to communicate with people who were, in some ways, your counterparts during the Cold War?
It was absolutely fascinating. That was in the joy of doing this book, is to be able to sit down with the opponents because of the respect I developed for the Red Army. In fact, I dedicated the book to the cold warriors on both sides who served their own gods, but when it came to nuclear weapons, they were careful. Soviet nuclear scientists, I had designed nukes. I have seen them go off. It's a frightening experience. To a quarter century later, to sit down in the Soviet weapons laboratories and talk to my counterparts was mind-boggling, because we knew something about their weapons, but they were very open. They viewed nuclear weapons as a very difficult technical challenge. I found it the same. On the other hand, we developed those weapons to defend our countries and our systems, but at the same time, we had all seen a nuclear weapon go off, and we understood how terrible that was, and we spent a lot of time toasting each other that, thank heavens, we never came to that.
My guest is Thomas Reed. His new book is called At the Abyss, An Insider's History of the Cold War. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Thomas Reed. He's the author of the new book, At the Abyss, An Insider's History of the Cold War. He's former Secretary of the Air Force and a nuclear engineer who worked on the design of a couple of nuclear weapons. He was also the National Security Assistant to President Reagan. Now, you worked on the design of two nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons, you know, obviously can be used to protect our country against an enemy, but they're also the most destructive tool humans have ever created. When you were designing nuclear weapons, obviously you're thinking about the protective aspect of them, but how do you handle the destructive side? How do you handle psychologically knowing that if this weapon is used, you know, that millions of civilians could be killed by it?
It's a real conflict. They are not, I would say, not used to protect, because that sort of implies you're going to go to war. But I think certainly the U.S. leadership from Eisenhower on down to the physicists understood that deterrence is what we wanted to do. We wanted to have a capability so overwhelming that the Soviet Union would not engage in adventurism. And our views were, and I think mine still are to this day, that if you do your job right, if you have nukes and the other guy knows that they will work for sure and they will be delivered for sure, then they will be deterred from adventures and will be better behaved. And I think that's the way it worked on both sides, that both the U.S. and the Soviet Union were deterred from serious military adventures against each other. And we had a quarter century of stability, if not peace, that we all thought in the laboratories, because we have seen nukes go off. You know, most people, you know, no one 10 years younger than me have seen a nuke go off. I've seen them go off.
Yeah, and I'm going to ask you about that in a moment. But I'm just wondering, like, did you allow yourself, or can you not allow yourself to have in the back of your mind the thought, what if? What if one accidentally goes off? What if there is a nuclear war? What if...
Oh, I think the what if one goes off accidentally was very much in people's mind, and that one of the real contributions of the Kennedy years after Cuba was to focus on the fact that we better make darn sure that these do not go off accidentally, or they don't go off because some officer loses his marbles or anything else. And so in the mid-60s, we designed into nuclear weapons what are known as permissive action links, which makes it absolutely impossible. And that's, I use that word advisedly, absolutely impossible for nukes to go off accidentally or to go off unintentionally. You now have to have a code that is held by the president, punched into the equivalent of an ATM in any weapon to activate it. And if you have a weapon and you shoot holes in it or anything else, you still can't make it go off. We spent a lot of time paying attention to those considerations.
Would you describe what it's like to witness the test of a bomb that you helped create?
Whether it's one I created or just to see a nuclear explosion, because the tests were conducted in the Pacific around the equator at a place called Christmas Island. And you go out there for the test of a device you designed, but you basically stay for a week, and there's a shot every morning. And words simply fail me that people speak of, well, small nukes of five or 10 kilotons. You just don't understand. A megaton is beyond belief. It is not a pop of light. It's a flood of light that you finally take off the dark glasses after minutes, and the sky is still as light as though the sun were burning right there. There is an oppressive heat. It's not just a flash of heat. Suddenly, the air is hot. You're being radiated by this fireball that is 20 or 25 miles away. And you have this feeling, I've just got to get away from this. And then when you finally get used to it, along comes the shockwave. And again, it's 25 miles away. And nonetheless, it knocks over people. It knocks over coffee cups. And it just goes on and on and on. And it's an experience that burns itself into everyone's mind who has seen one go off. And it makes us all very aware that these are dangerous things.
How did you protect yourself when watching the blast from 20, 25 miles away?
First thing is to be 25 miles away and don't get any closer and hope nobody gets closer to you. Number two is totally blackened glasses that you cannot see with these glasses on. They're goggles. You cannot see anything. You can't walk, or you just put them on and stand still. And then, as I say, when the light seems to be going, you take them off, and the sky is still as bright as can be. Beyond that, you're 25 miles away. You're in the tropics, so you're lightly dressed. There's no protective clothing. That the shots don't go off unless the wind is away from the island and the conditions are safe.
Do you feel like you have experienced any hazardous health effects?
No.
As a result of your proximity to these blasts?
No. We are 25 miles away. That the weapons laboratories take great care. Everybody wears a film badge, and I have never had any indication mm-hmm. that I suffered any problems.
Did your sense of responsibility change after actually witnessing a bomb go off?
Absolutely. That you come to understand that you're not just dealing with a firecracker or another artillery shell. And Russians had exactly the same feeling. That, you know, early in the atomic age, the chief of staff of the Soviet military wrote papers about how nuclear weapons are just bigger and better artillery. And it was only after the leadership saw nuclear tests at Semipalatinsk in the Soviet Union that they came to realize, that's not the case. Same thing with me.
You write a little bit in your book, At the Abyss, about the difficulties of controlling the nuclear weapons that we had based in Europe, in NATO countries. You were director of telecommunication and command and control systems for the Secretary of Defense for what years was that?
I was the director of telecommunications from 1973 to 1976.
So you were responsible for American communication with the weapons and the people controlling the weapons.
That's right.
How did the system work?
Well, the system worked very well for securing the weapons in terms of seeing to it that they were not enabled, they were not usable. By then, all these weapons had permissive action links, and so they were quite well controlled, but the communications were designed basically to issue the release authority, to send essentially the codes from the president to the troops that are stationed in the mountains of NATO countries, saying, we've gone to war, it's okay to release these nukes. They were not designed to find out what's the conditions there. And when suddenly we became concerned because one NATO ally got in a fight with another, we were concerned about gee whiz, what happens if they decide they want to grab some of these weapons that are stationed on their soil and use them against their neighbor? And we want to call up the facilities because the nuclear weapons were stored under the control of American forces. But basically, it was a few dozen officers and GIs relying on the local troops to really defend the place against Russian attack. That when you want to call up and ask what is going on, you basically had to operate through a shortwave radio link that was not very reliable. And one of my contributions to history was to learn that lesson and to go as quickly as possible to satellite communications directly to all those sites.
Was there ever a period at the height of Cold War and at the height of nuclear proliferation where you thought, this is just impossible, there are so many weapons between what the United States has, what the Soviets have, the weapons that were in Europe, that they're just going to be impossible to control?
No, I never thought they were impossible to control, I suppose because I was involved in designing the controls. And both I, and it's very interesting that now that I can talk to my Soviet counterparts, it just inspired us to pay a lot of attention to the controls and to see to it that if a weapon gets stolen, so what? If one falls out of an airplane, so what? In 1966, we had a B-52 collide with its tanker over Palomares, Spain, and it was deemed to be a crisis. Four megaton-sized weapons fell to the beach and into the Med. But the facts are, the one that fell on the beach just sat there like a big metal tube. It hadn't had the arming signal put in, and so people sat on it as a picnic bench until the Air Force came and took it away. One that fell in the Med had a dented nose, but it's still on display at a museum in Albuquerque. I think the numbers made us really pay attention to the matter of controls, and I think that, and I mean, I think, I know that we had great confidence that we had adequate controls. The issue was to not let the politics get out of control.
Were there any accidents like that in the United States where weapons fell to Earth?
There have been a lot of accidents in the U.S. where weapons fell out of burning airplanes or something like that. There has never been any release of nuclear yield of any sort ever in the United States or by a U.S. weapon. There have been accidents because nuclear weapons start with high explosives, and so they are filled with high explosives, and if you drop them or you do the wrong thing, you can make the high explosives go off. The trick is to design the safety systems so they simply blow the plutonium out one side and nothing bad happens. There have been dozens. It started at the time of Korea. Until Korea, nuclear weapons were held by the Atomic Energy Commission in vaults. Once Korea started, weapons were moved forward to the Air Force to be more ready to counterattack. And without a lot of safety precautions, we were concerned, and airplanes did crash. I mean, planes crash, and they have bombs in them. Greater and greater safety precautions occurred, such that since 1980, there has not been a single episode where a nuclear weapon has been accidentally destroyed.
Thomas Reed is the author of At the Abyss, An Insider's History of the Cold War. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Thomas Reed, author of At the Abyss, An Insider's History of the Cold War. Reed started his career in the late 50s working on the design of nuclear weapons. From 1976 to 77, he was Secretary of the Air Force. He served as President Reagan's Special Assistant for National Security Policy. He's also run his own businesses. There were people, including some politicians during the war in Vietnam, who basically said, nuke them. You know, let's make this a decisive victory and get it over with and just use a nuclear bomb. What was your reaction to hearing talk like that?
That seemed to be absolute folly, but it turns out that from beginning to end in Vietnam, nuclear weapons were always on the table. It was very clear that we were granting all this safe zones in Hanoi. We wouldn't bomb downtown Hanoi. It was very clear that one megaton weapon on Hanoi would have totally taken out the leadership of North Vietnam, would have changed the war, and upon occasions people would say, you know, just one shot would clean this whole thing up, to precluding the logistic support that there was a plan to put nuclear weapons up along the Chinese border in North Vietnam to keep the Chinese from supplying North Vietnam. Those ideas were considered to be folly, that the people that were in positions of leadership well understood. But the story of the Cold War is over and over again, the political leadership coming close to the nuclear edge. I mean, it wasn't just the use of nukes. It was doing things that would have offended nuclear powers. That the Soviet Union had trawlers that would hang out off the coast of Guam, watching B-52s take off for the flights to Vietnam. A lot of the troops on the island said, let's just go sink those ships. Sinking a ship of another country at sea is an act of war and could have precipitated all sorts of things. And so the military on the spot were very irritated because those trawlers were tipping off the anti-aircraft batteries, but the people in Washington said, that's freedom of the seas, and you start doing that, you are irritating a nuclear power. That is not a good idea.
There have been periods when our nuclear policy has basically been deterrence, and when the official policy was, you know, basically that nuclear weapons are so destructive, their use is unthinkable unless we truly have to, you know, use it in retaliation. However, some people say that the whole idea of nuclear weapons being unthinkable isn't quite true anymore because we have smaller tactical nuclear weapons that wouldn't be as destructive as, say, the bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, wouldn't be as destructive as the hydrogen bomb, and that we could use these tactical bombs in a more strategic way, making the possibility of nuclear weapons thinkable. Where do you think we are now in terms of, like, the thinkability of the use of nuclear weapons?
Well, let's see, Terry, there's a lot of the points in there. First of all, Hiroshima and Nagasaki were, by our standards today, tactical weapons. Those are not megaton weapons. Those were very small weapons. And that's one of the frightening aspects. We saw what happened at those places with very small weapons. I don't think there are people that seriously think we ought to use tactical nuclear weapons per se. There is thought given to what are you going to do about the deep underground bunkers of the Saddam Husseins and the Muammar Gaddafis if they don't shape up. And I'm not sure that that makes technical sense, but at least it's worth looking at. But I don't think there is rational thought that we ought to use tactical nuclear weapons. The issue really is goes the other way, that the world, the Cold War is over, but the nuclear threat is not. First of all, the technology is proliferating. Mr. Khan in Pakistan is running a nuclear Walmart. Secondly, plutonium and uranium sloshes around the Soviet Union. They lock up their weapons, but they don't really know where all the plutonium is because they never kept track of it. And thirdly, there are terrorist groups that would like to use weapons on the U.S. That not perhaps well remembered is that in 1993, terrorists packed a Ryder truck full of fertilizer and ammonia and drove it into the, parked it in the basement of the World Trade Center, blew it up, killed six people and injured thousands. At Livermore, we did a little study of, well, now, supposing they had had access to some plutonium that they got from the Soviet Union, and suppose they looked on the web for just the most rudimentary design information, what could they have done? And we concluded, well, anybody could have gotten at least 5 kilotons out of that sort of a load of high explosives. And then, and 5 kilotons at the World Trade Center, that's a third of Hiroshima. And we then took our computer codes and looked at, what does this mean? Well, what it meant is 5 kilotons at the World Trade Center means everyone south of Central Park is dead. It means radiation all over Manhattan. That is a very distinct possibility, that the technology is out there, the plutonium is loose in Russia, and there are people that are determined to put it there. And therefore, we had better pay a lot of attention to tracking all of these things, so that tactical nuclear weapons, not in the sense of a superpower bouncing around the world, but in the sense of terrorists inflicting that on us, is a distinct possibility.
Do you think that although the Soviets and the Americans managed to control their nuclear weapons during the Cold War and to avoid a nuclear confrontation, that now that the Cold War is over, many of those Soviet weapons are unaccounted for, they're loose, are you afraid that nuclear material from the Cold War will eventually fall into the hands of terrorists, and that the aftermath of the Cold War will prove to be more dangerous in terms of nuclear weapons than the Cold War itself was?
That's a multiple choice question, Terry. First of all, the weapons are not loose. I have the greatest confidence because I know the officers involved. The nuclear weapons, once they are designed and assembled into weapons, they are very closely controlled. The Soviets built a lockout system that in many ways is far more sturdy than that in the U.S. And I have very little concern about a nuclear weapon, that is, with a button on the side and all the arming and fusing and electronics and so forth, falling into the hands of bad guys. I do not believe that that's a possibility, and if it were, the Soviets have designed in the same sort of safety measures, so you can have a megaton warhead drawn from the U.S. or the Soviet inventory, and you could use it for a coffee table because there's no way you can make it go off, and if you try to get inside, the whole thing will melt. The other issue that you raise, however, is the materials. That's very different. In the U.S., when we produced plutonium or uranium, we weighed it and we accounted for it, and we know where every gram of it is. In the Soviet Union, it was just so much coal. They produced uranium, and they just kept on producing it. They produced plutonium, and they still do, because the reactors that produce plutonium are also reactors that heat the cities out in the on the east side of the Urals. And so the country is awash with that material. That is the danger, that the materials, the enriched uranium and the plutonium, are not accounted for, and I am quite sure that there are bad guys busy trying to find it and buy it, as we Americans are trying to help the Russians find it and get it out of there and cycled into the nuclear power industry.
And are you losing sleep about this, or?
Well, at my age, losing sleep is not something I do. You know, I have a lot of faith in the U.S. system. I guess I work at Livermore. We spend a lot of time trying to help Russians find their material. It's not as though they're a bunch of cowboys. They are very interested in locating this material. You know, a very interesting episode, a lot of nuclear material was left in Kazakhstan when the empire fell apart. Kazakhstan, Ukraine, and Belarus had nuclear weapons and nuclear materials. In the early 90s, the president of Kazakhstan called the president of the United States and said, we have just opened a barn out here in near Semipalatinsk, and we find all these drums full of enriched uranium. Would you please get them out of here? And that the U.S. and the Kazakh government mounted an episode that a couple of C-5s flew in there, and in the dark of night, the Kazakhs loaded this stuff in. It was taken to Oak Ridge, to Georgia, where it was recycled into fuel rods for reactors, and the Kazakhs got paid for it. There's a great cooperative effort by the governments to not have nuclear materials just rattling around loose, but there's a lot of it, and it was not accounted for. It's a tough struggle.
My guest is Thomas Reed. His new book is called At the Abyss, An Insider's History of the Cold War. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Thomas Reed. He's the author of the new book, At the Abyss, An Insider's History of the Cold War. He's the former Secretary of the Air Force and a former National Security Assistant to President Reagan. He worked on the design of two nuclear weapons. You worked with President Reagan. In fact, you worked with him even before he became the president. You helped him organize his first gubernatorial campaign.
That's right. I knew him when he got to Washington. I probably knew him as well as anybody in town. I was his Northern California chairman in 66 when he ran for governor. I was his personnel chief when he first was governor, and then I went back to run my business. I was totally in charge of his reelection campaign in 1970. So I knew him, lived with him, know him exceedingly well.
What's your sense of him as a president and as a man?
Well, as a president, I think he put the pieces in place to end the Cold War. People say he won the Cold War. No one person did that. But I think he brought a different mindset to the White House. He brought a mindset that this Cold War is not going to go on forever. Somebody's going to win and somebody's going to lose, and it's time to decide who that is. And enough time has gone by that the Soviet system is imploding, and he was willing to listen to the young outside economists saying they are going broke, which was not the conventional wisdom. So what he brought to the White House was a different mindset, that he was not enamored of detente. He was of the view that the Soviet system is an evil system and it's going to collapse and we're going to push on it to make it collapse. As a human being, he's different than all the rest of us, but presidents generally are, that he was very self-possessed, very self-confident. He knew what he believed in, and therefore he didn't spend a bunch of time agonizing over what he ought to do. Calling a focus group before making a decision would have been absolutely unthinkable. And because he was so self-assured, people thought he was shallow. He wasn't shallow. He just was not interested in debating whether or not the Soviet Union was a sensible place. He knew it wasn't. And secondly, what people don't understand is his mind operated 10 times as fast as the rest of us. And that's why he was so good in debates and press conferences and meetings with people. He would look to be bored. That's because in a few seconds he could size up where you were going and what you were going to say. A most amazing mind in that regard.
Part of what he ran on was a campaign of family values. And I guess I'm curious what you thought of that part of Ronald Reagan. And let me just add one piece of information in asking this. I know that there was something in your life that was kind of contradictory to the family values thing. I read that although you were married, there was a period when you were working for the government when you had a couple of lovers, and one of them you made your special assistant and placed on the Pentagon payroll. You can correct me if I'm wrong. I'm just reading things. So, but I mentioned a private life only because of that sense of it being so counter to the program of the president that you worked for and represented.
We got to go back and straighten out the record about my personal life.
Please,
I did not place a lover on the payroll. My personal life did not do well, and I ended up being divorced as I left Washington. But the lady I married, I had worked for me in the Pentagon because she had become a friend, as I described a friend in Ronald Reagan. But we got to be sure to get them all in the right order. The question regarding Ronald Reagan was what?
Oh, that his family values, you know, traditional values emphasis. Did that work for you given the life that you were leading?
Oh, I think at my time, my life was very conventional and very normal. I don't think my life was worth writing up in Playboy or anyplace else. I think that the stresses of being in Washington finally cracked a marriage apart. I think that what struck me early on was his attachment to his children. But when I first met him, we talked about how he liked to do things with his kids and how he kept an audio scrapbook of his kids and so forth. But I think growing up in Hollywood and I think there were a lot of other issues in his life that led to his relationships with his children being strained. But this is not a news story in America. This happens a lot.
I guess that's what I'm wondering about, if it struck you as hypocritical. Knowing how close you were to President Reagan and how many years you worked with him, if his emphasis on family values struck you as hypocritical. Like you mentioned, your marriage broke up because of the stresses in Washington, and how common a story is that? Very common. Do you think that the traditional family values campaign took the real stresses of late 20th century life into account?
Well, perhaps it was objectives or wishful thinking that a lot of people say, my life has not been perfect, but this is the way I think human beings ought to conduct themselves. I don't think he was hypocritical. I think he saw what he thought would be sensible values, and he was a faithful husband and a good guy, and he tried to be a good father. I don't think he was hypocritical. I think that just the stresses of life, when he became governor, it really impacted his children. That can be tough.
You say that you think President Reagan had no deep and lasting friends as most of us understand the word. You don't think he had deep friends?
No. By friends, I mean, you and I know what that means. It means people you just pour a cup of coffee with and you sit and you talk about the ball game and you talk about your love life and you talk about the kids and you talk about the sorry state of the government and you talk about the meaning of life and you talk about God and so forth and so on. He didn't do that. He did not, in my experience, have friends. He may have in his younger days, and maybe as he grew older, my life changed. But in my experience, in the years I knew him, which started in the mid-60s, he did not have any friends that he sat and just trusted to talk with. Now, as I said in this little tome, he had compartmented friends. He had a minister to whom he was very close. He had a wife who was his lover, who took care of him, who protected him, and who he cared about a lot.
There's a point in your book where you describe President Reagan as an increasingly confused president. What were you referring to?
I think that, it came in stages. As I say, I've known him forever. That after the shooting in March of 81, he suffered oxygen loss to the brain and getting shot at that age. I mean, I'm now at that age, and I would not relish getting shot and trying to recover from that. It basically changed him. It slowed him down. That he was still in those years when I worked for him. He was he knew exactly where he was going, and he was very clearly focused. I think as he got into his second term, the staff that really understood him began to drift away, and I think that he was beginning to age. And by the end of his second term, I think that it was time to retire. I think that he was by 92. I saw him again, and at that time, he really was beginning to lose it. He really didn't understand who I was. Mm-hmm.
Thomas Reed, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's been a great delight being with you.
Thomas Reed is the author of the new book, At the Abyss, An Insider's History of the Cold War.